This special episode is an Independent Politics 101 workshop. To learn more about the Green Socialist Organizing Project's 101 series, visit greensocialist.net/101s.
Everybody, thank you for joining us for our second 101 workshop of 2023. This year we are breaking the mold from the previous year. In 2022, every month we cycled through quarterly and hit Green Party 101, Eco-Socialism 101, Organizing 101. We did that for the full year, cycling through those workshops, and coming into 2023, we said we were going to not abandon those, but mix it up a little. So we opened in January with a cut down 1 hour version of our Green Party 101. And then this month we are doing what was obviously which was honestly the obvious choice, Independent Politics 101. We talked about independent politics in probably every single one of our previous 101 workshops. It's key to understanding the Green Party. It's key to understanding socialism. It's key to doing effective bottom-up organizing. So today we're going to talk about Independent Politics 101. Much of today, one thing we did say when we were getting ready for this was, this is a workshop we're probably going to come back to. This is a workshop we're going to tinker, and figure out. But for this first Independent Politics workshop today, we are going to use Howie Hawkins' ebook, The Case for an Independent Left Party, kind of as our guide, though we did mix up, the order a little, and we've added some things as well. But for this first one, that ebook is going to be our guide. You can get the link into the chat, but you can, like I said, it's free, and you can get it at greensocialist.net. Right up at top, it says ebook, or you can go to that link. So, to get started, my name is Chris Blankenhorn. I'm the Illinois Green Party secretary, former national co-chair for the Green Party of the United States, and one of the organizers with the Green Socialist Organizing Projects Education Working Group. with me is Garrett Wasserman, and I'll let him tell you about his hats.
Yeah, hi everyone. I'm Garrett, and I'm also a former GPUS co-chair at this point.
We didn't that.
Yeah. So it's been a long term, and I resigned a little bit early because I want to focus more on doing these workshops and educational stuff. But in addition to that, I've been active in the Green Party of Pennsylvania and the Green Party of Allegheny County, which is Pittsburgh. Where I've worked on a number of ballot access campaigns to, put the Green Party on the ballot and, work to organize and educate. So that's what we're here for. So I'm excited. Let's jump into it, huh?
Yeah. So independent politics, right? It is probably one of the central debates of the left. I would say in two ways. One, fundamentally, the debate about party independence, right? There's the independent left, and then there's a whole left that is, at least in some way, tethered to or oriented towards the Democratic Party. That's a big. It's called a strategy debate often. We take the position that it's actually not a strategy. It shouldn't be considered a strategy debate. Independence is fundamental to socialist organizing. It's not something that should be up for debate. It's a key part of what we mean when we say we're socialist organizers. So it's that important, it's a really important part of the discussion. But then also, it brings into the conversation electoralism, which is another major point of debate on in the U.S. left, right? So I think it's good to talk about it and talk about it in both those contexts. But to start off, we're going to start off with some quotes, just kind of, get us hearing some perspective on this from some key thinkers. An obvious one, a very popular one, is it's better, Eugene Debs said, it's better to vote for what you want and not get it than to vote for what you don't want and get it. And it's that's a quote from a century ago that is so applicable in our modern politics, right? I talk often about, in the United States, the way I term it is we have a negative voting culture, right? Where people vote against things rather than voting for them. I would bet if you asked most voters in 2020, especially for presidential, right? I bet most voters would list things they were voting against primarily, right? Same in 2016, right? We have incredibly unpopular mainstream candidates, yet tens of millions of people voted for each of them. And many of them did so while openly expressing their disgust, right? So we have a political culture that has us voting for what we don't want. And that guarantees that we're going to get it and we're not going to like it. So, despite this being a 100-year-old quote, it's dead on for, the current U.S. political culture and the negative, the negative-oriented voting that we have. Next up is a little longer and even older from Karl Marx. Even when there is no prospect whatsoever of their being elected, the workers must put up their own candidates in order to preserve their independence, count their forces, and bring before the public their revolutionary attitude and party standpoint. In this connection, they must not allow themselves to be seduced by such arguments of the Democrats as, for example, that by doing so they are splitting the Democratic Party and making it possible for the reactionaries to win. That ultimate intention of all such phrases is to dupe the proletariat, the advance of which the proletarian party is bound to make by such independent action is indefinitely more important than the disadvantage that might be incurred by the presence of a few reactionaries in the representative body, right? So Marx very much makes the point that we need to put ourselves out there. And one of the ways that we can do that is, through party politics, independent party politics. Garrett, do you have anything on that one? I took it from you last month.
Yeah, I think my comment, both for the Eugene Debs quote as well as from Karl Marx here, is that there's a very rich history throughout socialist history going back a long time, both in Europe with Marx and in the U.S. with Debs, of a focus on independent politics being very important to building working class power, against the bourgeoisie, right? Against the ruling class, the owning class, the capitalist class, whatever you want to call it. We can't build our own working class power by working within those structures that are meant to constrain us into the system as it exists today. We have to build our own institutions that can carry working class power. And so, that means starting off with independence, even knowing that that's going to be difficult at first, but there's no shortcut to winning working class power. We have to start organizing from the bottom up, from the ground up.
Yeah, I really like the phrase of, not for, right? we don't need to be advocates. We need to, build and empower the working class as a whole. Not simply be outsiders who advocate on behalf of them, which is all you could ever really do from within a capitalist party. That leads us into the next one, which is Lenin. Far from causing harm, to the revolutionary proletariat. Sorry, there's an unhappy toddler. Far from causing harm to the revolutionary proletariat, participation in a bourgeoisie democratic parliament, even a few weeks before the victory of a Soviet republic, and even after such a victory, actually helps the proletariat to prove to the backward masses why such parliaments deserve to be done away with. It facilitates their successful dissolution and helps make bourgeoisie parliamentarianism politically obsolete. So, you know, Lenin even makes the point that even if we disagree with the structures in which we are running, running in them exposes their failures, right? And can actually accelerate, the dissolution of, these bodies that aren't usually actually democratic, right? we live in the United States. We like to talk about democracy, but this never was intended to be a democracy. This was a government by and of and for oligarchs from the beginning. Even Lenin says, even if you don't support the institutions that you're running in, you can do, you know, one of the tools that we have in our tool chest is to, run in those elections and expose the systems that, that we oppose. I think an important thing to think about when we're having, this discussion about party politics and electoralism, I think the main important point is to not think of it as either or. We've got to be doing electoralism, dual power, mutual aid, community organizing. We need many, many fronts of organizing if we're going to overcome capitalism. So, while we may kind of talk a lot about electoral stuff in this workshop because it's about party politics, that is not a advocacy that electoral politics is the end all be all and where we should put, a large portion of our work. How much focus, we talk about this in our organizing workshop some, right? Like at any given time in your local organization, it may make sense or not to run people. It depends where you are in your development. But we should always keep it as something in our tool chest. And something that I've always thought on this issue, as someone who's involved in electoral politics but hates them, much like Lenin seems to, is the idea that, like it or not, power has been sequestered within the electoral realm, not just in the United States, but in many ways for most of the world. And so if we are, as the left, as socialists, going to abandon, if we're going to abandon one of the main areas where power, the ability to exert power in our society exists, we're very much limiting ourselves, right? Like it or not, that's where it is. So we need to fight there. We also need to fight other places, but it's one of the places we need to, at least consider tactically, and not just write off. Do you have anything before I jump to the next, which changes? So this next one, if voting changed anything, they'd make it illegal, right? And this is generally a quote that is used as a rallying call against electoralism, often by anarchists, which is unsurprising, given it's coming from Emma Goldman, an anarchist. But one thing I've always really liked about this quote is that it's prophetic, and it showed an understanding of history. While this may seem like a condemnation, and I'm sure it was coming from her, it's also a statement of fact. When voting has threatened to actually change things, they make it illegal, right? A key example that even Emma Goldman would have, was around for would be, after the Civil War, right? We saw a brief flash of Black representation in the South. And then all of a sudden rules changed. Poll taxes came in, Jim Crow came in, tests that you had to take, literacy tests came in, and they actually did manage to make it illegal to vote. And we see it even in modern times, right? Like in 2020, the Democrats in New York used COVID as cover to hide a bill that tripled the amount of signatures it took to get on the ballot as a third party, right? They didn't make it illegal, they just made it de facto impossible. right? They made it, they knew they couldn't come right out and say, the Green Party, the Libertarian Party, off the ballot, you can't run anymore, right? That wouldn't, even in you know, what the laughable thing that we call democracy here in the U.S., that wouldn't quite fly. What they can do, and what, you know, even the Supreme Court has supported, is make it extremely hard for us to get on the ballot, right? And so after seeing, you know, successes from the Green Party in statewide campaigns, successes from, you know, the 2016 presidential election, the Democrats in New York inserted into a COVID relief bill, you know, a law that tripled the amount of signatures and made it damn near impossible. A number of signatures no parties could collect in New York, and I believe recorded history. And I want to say only once or twice in the last century has any third party candidate gotten enough votes to qualify under the new law, right? So while it does seem to be antithetical to what we are talking about, I think the prophetic nature of Emma Goldman's quote is, you know, something that we should remember, because power is sequestered there. And when we are able to actually threaten it, they do make it illegal. You know, in Illinois, even if you run for office in Illinois, in that packet that you have to fill out to run is a loyalty oath that swears you're not a member of a communist party. Now, that loyalty oath has been declared by the Supreme Court to be null and void. You don't have to fill it out, right? You don't have to turn it in. You don't have to mess with it, but it's in there. And I bet you a lot of candidates do still fill it out. So I think it's important to remember when we have this conversation that, you know, it does present an avenue that real challenges to power can happen. They tend to make it illegal.
Yeah.
Restrict it.
Yeah, that was always kind of the I don't know if ironic is the right word, but the different way that I would see this, because you're right, a lot of folks will throw it around as sort of a justification for I shouldn't be involved in electoralism. But really, it's kind of the opposite, that voting, and maybe not the act of voting by itself, but the act of organizing independent politics, of organizing for issues and organizing for candidates that will support those issues and all, is where the power is. And whenever that starts to form is when you start to see restrictions on elections and the voting process. When candidates run together, we refer to that as a ticket. And in history, it was a ticket because you would literally cut out a ticket, like a coupon from like a newspaper or something. You'd say, hey, I like these candidates in the ad, and I'm going to vote for them. And you would drop that ticket into the voting booth and things like that. And because of various reasons here, for one thing, there could have been like fraud and things like that. But one way that used to press independent candidates and all is by putting in all of these state barriers to getting on the ballot. And you have the state control who's on the ballot, and you have the state control who's allowed to vote and who's registered to vote, and all of these things. So they keep putting these restrictions on there over time that almost make it illegal, or at least almost make it illegal to vote for anything but the folks that are already in power. In some sense, it actually confirms this, that voting and organizing the vote, and really, like I said, broadly organizing independent politics, is something that can be very threatening to power, which is why they try to restrict it so much and restrict the conversation by making it harder to vote and convincing you that, you know, oh, it's just a spoiler and it doesn't matter, and, you know, all this stuff, right? So we should consider it how useful it is to use electoralism both to push our own power in legislative ways, but also to organize our forces, like Marx was talking about, and to put our message out to the public, and use it as a platform to educate others about the changes that society really needs to get to where we need to go. Green Socialism and the Green Party are about more than just electoralism. It's an activist organization too, as we've said in previous 101s, and we'll talk about more as we go. All right.
So like we said, we're going to use our free ebook, The Case for an Independent Left Party, The link is in the chat. You can get it. You know, it's super short, right? One of the reasons I love this ebook, and one of the reasons why we talk about it and push it so much, is it's incredibly short and digestible, right? The whole thing is less than 30 pages total. I don't think there's a section probably that's more than 2 pages, right? So, and it's pieced out in a way that makes it so you could read one section, discuss it, right? In your local or in your locals and things like that. So that's our model, right? For this workshop, we did rearrange it a little. So let's talk about what we have first, right? Before we start having a conversation on what we should have, we need to make sure we have a firm understanding of what we do have. And here in the United States, we have what are called memberless parties. The party tends to be tightly controlled by insiders that know the rules. Insiders tend to be elected officials and staff putting the party under political donor control rather than accountable to voters or the public. Donors pay for access to insiders. Insiders then use that money to campaign and get insiders reelected to keep up the cycle, right? Where this is how the institutional parts of the Republican and Democratic parties work. Party conventions are now patronage rituals for fundraising and marketing, just like any other capitalist enterprises, rather than deliberative gatherings. It used to be that the presidential candidates were decided at the nominating conventions, and now they are, you know, like that says, just giant PR shows. And then without a membership structure, voters do not have any rights or duties within the party, and therefore typically there's no course of action within the party against representatives and officers that don't represent them. So a big problem with parties and how they exist and how they manifest in the United States is that, I think the key there is the bottom, is that last point, right? There's no membership structure. Parties don't, when people say they're a Democrat, I don't know what that means other than they vote Democrat when they vote. Because for the most part, and there are exceptions, right? There are people who serve as precinct committee people. There are people who might go to, you know, a local membership meeting or something like that. But for the most part, voters have no active role within their party. They don't have an active role really in any way other than voting. Most of them aren't even voting in primaries, right? Where your vote might actually say one way or the other, where you are on policies that are in debate within within the Democratic Party. So like if you're one of the 90%+ of Democrats that supported Medicare for All in 2020 and knew you were voting Democrat, you know, come general election, the only chance you got to make that expression of your support for Medicare for All was during the primary, right? That's the only time. And most voters don't vote in the primary. Because once it came time to actually, be in the general election, Medicare for All wasn't on the table, right? The Democratic nominee had said he would veto it if it got passed. So when you have these voter-based parties where that's the only identifier you have, it really means that the people have no control. Mm-hmm. The people have no power. We even saw in... was it Nevada, where a progressive slate took control of the state party?
Yeah, the Nevada DSA, I think, actually took over the state party.
And they got people elected to enough positions that they had a majority in the state party. And I don't remember if it was within a year. It was just recently that they put out this letter. But they recently put out a letter within a year or two of actually succeeding in taking power that it was impossible to reform the Democratic Party. That even from positions of power, they could not break the hold, and they advocated for a break.
Yeah, and see, their letter touches on basically the two key points from this slide. That first, when the DSA took over the state party, the donors for the Nevada Democratic Party weren't going to support people that claim to be socialist and all. So all of the donors left, all of the money left, The old leadership of the party literally transferred out all of the money to other Democratic campaign committees so that the Nevada State Party had nothing left, basically. And they didn't have money to pay staffers and stuff, so the staffers left and went to go support other Democratic Party things. So the Nevada Democratic Party that was taken over by DSA had basically nothing left because they had no donors. And they also didn't have this membership structure. So they couldn't participate in the rest of the Democratic Party, which essentially locked them out. So we see kind of the problems on the slide and exactly their experience at trying to take over a state party. And this lack of membership is really the fundamental issue with all capitalist parties. Not just Republicans and Democrats, but, you know, we see that in even other parties that we'll talk about. You're not a member, you're just a voter, and so you don't have any influence, you don't have any say, you don't have any vote on internal party policy. So, for example, when presidential candidates are picked and all, they also technically put together a platform and stuff like that. Do you vote on the platform? No, it's party insiders, it's superdelegates. All of those folks put together what they want to see the Democratic Party doing, not with the input of the grassroots people, because there are no members in the Democratic Party.
I actually just found their statement and put it in the chat so folks can read it. Right. So we talked about, you know, it's a good segue into, you know, do these reforms work? Right. So during the progressive era, the primary system was implemented in the 1910s. It was meant to take candidate selection out of the hands of party bosses. However, I think we have a pretty clear view today, you know, 120 years later, about how successful that's been, right? They weren't deterred. They simply became the managers of the primaries, right? We always have to remember when we're doing this organizing that is fundamentally anti-capitalist organizing, that capitalism is incredibly adaptable, right? Its ability to adjust to systems of power is really incredible. a lot of it comes with having a lot of money, right? And already having the power. It's easier to adjust if you're already in power and you're sitting on a pile of money. You can shift a lot easier than the grassroots can. Fundamentally, when we're doing this work, we've got to remember that if we're just slightly tweaking a system, if we're not fundamentally changing things, if we're not fundamentally changing the lay of the land, we're at a disadvantage in terms of who can adapt faster. So if we, you know, take one hierarchical system, one anti-democratic hierarchical system that was party bosses choosing candidates, and replace it with a easily manipulated primary system that was in the hands of the states and in the hands of the party bosses, it should be pretty easy to see that capitalism and capitalist parties are going to be able to shift and take advantage of that old system just as much as they did now, as they did the new system just as much as they did the old, which means we have to have some caution, you know, when it comes to isolated reforms today. One question I always ask, coming from Illinois, what good is RSV if only Republicans and Democrats can get on the ballot? Right, there are multiple standalone ranked choice voting bills in the Illinois legislature right now. The Illinois Green Party is actually discussing which ones we should support, and we always support with critical support, right? We support this, but we need X, Y, and Z too. When you look at a state like Illinois, where we have some of the worst ballot access repression in the country, where to run for U.S. House from my district where I live in central Illinois as a Republican or a Democrat, it takes between 700 and 800 signatures. To run as a Green Party member, it takes me more than 15,000 in 90 days in a largely rural district. We got to double it, right? So we actually got to get 30,000 signatures in 90 days. And then that's that's more households that exist in my state capital where I live, right? So we're going to have to go into the deep red country where I grew up to get signatures too. So we can pass ranked choice voting bills in Illinois all we want, right? But it's not going to change anything except internal party politics for the Republicans and Democrats if they implement it in their primaries, which hurts us because it lures us in, right? It lures independents into voting Democrats so they can try to sway those primaries. But in Illinois, if you vote in the Democratic primary, that means there are certain things you're excluded from doing as an independent, right? People always ask me why I didn't vote in the Democratic primary in 2020, because if I had, I wouldn't have been able to be an Electoral College elector for the Greens, right? The law says I can't. And so when we fight for these, you know, another one is term limits, right? Term limits are pushed by people on both sides of the aisle, you know, as a way to counter corruption and career politicians. But will they fundamentally challenge things, or will power be able to pivot, right? Will there, instead of being a career politician, be a line of career politicians ready to take their 8-year stand as U.S. House or as state House members, and then they can switch over and they can run for city or county or state Senate or U.S. Congress, right? Will it just create a revolving door of puppets instead of one corrupt puppet? And when I was thinking about this when I wrote it earlier today, one thing I wondered was, could that make the corruption worse? Where you've only got 8 years to fill your pockets. You don't got 30, right? And so now it's a rush of, you know, getting your pet projects done and all that, because you've got a very limited time where you're able to be in power and do it. And my big argument against term limits has always been, it hurts working class candidates, right? If you're going to run and then know the job's gone in 4 years because you can only serve 2 terms as a representative, that's a big ask for a working class candidate to put it all on the line, right? To leave the job they have that's feeding their family for a chance at a job that will, you know, knowingly be done and send them into a career reset unless they can, you know, pivot like the capitalists can, which they likely can't. One thing it makes me think of is in 2020, we had a Green candidate running in Illinois, and he got interviewed by the local paper. And the local paper asked him, how will you deal with surviving on a legislator's salary? Illinois has some of the top paid legislators in the country. They make, I think, 60,000 to 70,000 baseline, and then you get more based on committee assignments and seniority and stuff. All he could do was laugh, right? He's like, dude, that's double I've ever made in my life.
In Pennsylvania, they make 90,000.
Yeah, right? And so that's how disconnected the working class is from our political system, and that's because of the, you know, what we talked about, the memberless party structure, right? And when independent candidates do run, they get asked ridiculous questions like this, right? Because their opponents are lawyers or their opponents are landlords. I learned the other day, like, almost half of Congress is a landlord. And it's like 428 out of the 535 or 228 out of the 535 or something, right? Or their opponent owns huge swaths of farmland across the county, right? And they're going to be slumming it for $60,000 a year. So we have to have a level of caution, especially when we're talking about one-off isolated reforms, right? And this is the one big reason why Greens, independent socialists should be pushing large, broad, omnibus democracy reforms. Because once we get our ranked choice voting, they're not going to give us anything else for another few decades. That's like one of those once in a generation changes. That means ballot access is off the table, right? That means Citizens United's off the table. That means multi-member districts, which are the real game changer of ending the first past the post system, right? Those are off the table. So we've got to make sure that even when we are advocating for these, you know, one-off reforms, that we're also advocating for the big picture and keeping in mind how, you know, these reforms are being done within the capitalist parties, which means that they're being done within the limits of what these parties think they can survive. they would never put themselves willingly at risk like this, right? If they pass it, it means they think they can continue to dominate in it. So we've got to keep that in mind.
Yeah. I'd add real fast that while this was focused on electoralism, the same is true about union organizing and all that. At this time period, there were radical unions that were really questioning the fundamental tenets of capitalism and the wage labor system itself. And to be part of the New Deal coalition in order to get some reforms instead of major system change, they got involved in the Democratic Party and watered down. And today's unions now are largely managers of capital as opposed to opposing capital itself. So, you know, we have to, and again, that, you know, that's working with capital and the Democratic Party. So it's a caution both from like the union side and from the political party side that we have to maintain our independence when we're fighting for a new system.
So the debate, right? The inside strategy debate. It's been tried many times. That's the thing that's always baffled me about it, is that it seems like every iteration of the inside strategy thinks it's discovered something that we haven't tried before.
Why I was very clear on this slide here that, we talked about the failures of trying to reform, primaries and all this stuff. And so the next idea everyone has is, well, let's try to change the Democratic Party. And that's what the inside strategy essentially is.
Take it away.
And there's a couple of different approaches here. There's an inside-outside fusion strategy where it's like, well, I'm kind of independent, but I kind of work with the Democrats when I need to as a fusion. And the other approach is the party within a party approach that you try to behave as like a caucus within the Democratic Party that pushes for change. And you can see from the slides here under both of them that like since the late 1800s, both of these approaches have been tried over and over and over and over again. None of these ideas are new ideas. You know, DSA didn't just suddenly discover, hey, we can be a caucus within the Democratic Party. This has been tried over and over and over again with the same results every time that it's been done.
They've tried it over and over.
DSA itself has been around since the 60s, more or less. I mean, it's a little complicated history, but... But that's what's listed here. The People's Party of 1896, the American Labor Party of the 1930s through the 50s, the Liberal Party of New York, that's from the end of World War II till today, the Vermont Progressive Party, the Working Families Party. We see the party within a party approach going back to McGovern's campaign, but, you know, DSA, the Rainbow Coalition, Democracy for America, all the way up to Sanders, Bernie Sanders, Our Revolution. Where is it? It didn't create an independent political structure. It just folded into the Democrats. And so we see this same track happen every single time a new candidate or a new organization tries it. It always gets co-opted and folded into the Democratic Party and folded into the needs of capital instead of being able to maintain its independence and actually push for, you know, true socialist systemic change. So, you know, the verdict here is that they get co-opted into the Democratic Party, and most reformists end up becoming careerists. They end up becoming the people that work within the Democratic Party. You know, you can look at the list of names here. Howard Dean, Kucinich. Woo! That's right. Kucinich, Obama, Sanders, every single one of them was considered to be this outside reformer when they started. And then after their campaign, they became, you know, insider DSA, insider Democratic Party super delegates, you know, with their special place within the party, and they became people that would bring those progressive movements into the party as opposed to trying to push them into more of an independent space. So, you know, this is not new, and it's not even like, well, we tried it once and maybe we could do it a little bit better, right? It's like over 100 years at this point of trying it over and over and over again and showing the failures. Most of the reformists end up as careerists within the party. Most of these organizations get folded into the party. And these organizing efforts, part of the reason they fail is because they always start off not as independent you know, working class organizations and parties, but they're always formed as these top down nonprofit sort of organizations that focus on mobilizing for the Democratic Party instead of helping communities organize for their own self-determination. And they're, as nonprofits, you know, they just collect profits and they start to pool donors, right? They end up with that same problem of being donor funded organizations as opposed to membership organizations. And so they end up with exactly the same problems that the Democratic Party itself has, which is partly why they're so easily co-optable. So I think this long-time record of these different strategies, again, points us toward the importance of maintaining independence, which we'll talk more about as I go. But let me throw it to Chris for comments.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I say when we talk about this quite a bit is The Democrats: A Critical History by Lance Selfa. It's on Haymarket Press. He actually owes us a new one, an updated version. But it goes into detail onto a lot of this. It goes into detail about, you know, as it says, a critical history, right? Of looking at the history of the Democratic Party and the history of attempts to, you know, reform it. And, you know, anytime I hear Kucinich, one of the first, you know, horror stories that I heard, when I became active in the National Green Party, was another young Green at the time told me a story, and that is that Kucinich came to their state party during the primary when he was running and said, I want to do a list swap. I want you to give me your membership lists, and I will use them to try to move the discussion in the Democratic Party to the left. I don't think anyone was delusional enough to think that Kucinich was going to win. So really the only thing on the table could have been moving the conversation. And then the agreement was after the primary, Kucinich would turn over his lists to the Green Party. That deal was made. Kucinich was given the lists. Greens were lobbied by Kucinich, by his Democratic primary campaign. His campaign ended. That list then went to the Democratic Party, and the Green Party got nothing. Right? And to be clear, this is, I don't know the state of the Democrats' legal maneuvering in terms of their primary at the time. But like when Bernie Sanders ran in 2016 and 2020, he signed contracts saying, every single person in my contact list goes to the DNC, right? That is a condition of running in the primary, was that you share your lists with the DNC afterwards. So I remember in 2016, all these Bernie supporters up in arms about, why are they getting Clinton emails? Well, Bernie sold you out. It was part of the agreement, and he sold you out before he even announced he ran, right? He sold you out when he signed that first round of paperwork, and he did the same thing, right? And it should have been clear, the trap should have been clear to that state party, but it wasn't, and they took the deal and got screwed over. And it really, like I said, it shouldn't surprise anyone, but that's what happens when we, you know, try to insert ourselves into this. And I often hear a question of, well, if Greens don't have a candidate, shouldn't we endorse someone, right? Or shouldn't we put our view out there, because otherwise we don't have a voice, which in a way can be true. But the problem with that is when you do that, right, when you don't have a candidate running in your local city council race, so you endorse a de facto Democrat instead, because most of the time city council, at least here in Illinois, is nonpartisan, right? So they're not a Democrat. Or they're, you know, they're, no one's anything, but we all know. When you do that, you use your voice solely to build up another party, right? You use that, you take all of your energies that should be put into building an independent political alternative, and you take all those energies and all that focus and what little cred and attention you have, and you put it into building the Democratic Party instead of yourself. So there are definitely ways that, Greens that don't have a candidate in the race can engage, especially on advocating for issues and making sure that the, you know, eco-socialist perspectives are part of the discussion in ways, but very rarely is, you know, throwing their voice behind a Democrat something that pays off in the long term. Even in times I can think of when I know of green locals who have supported Democrats, when they're elected, their voice doesn't carry any weight, right? Just like the rest of the grassroots of the Democratic Party doesn't carry any weight with their electives. The Greens also, right? Once they throw their weight in behind a Democrat, when they're elected, they don't get a seat at the table. We're still outside. So that, you know, it leads us to the question, what would a socialist alternative to the Democrats look like? It must adopt a strong socialist program for economic democracy and social ownership of the means of production, right? It's got to be socialist, not merely reforms of capitalism. And, you know, I know a lot of people credit Bernie with bringing socialism to the mainstream, but the problem with how he did it was that he also distorted it while doing it. And I honestly, I don't put much blame on Bernie personally for this. Bernie didn't say the word socialism very much after the very, very beginning, because I think Bernie probably is at least some level of a socialist. It was like, this isn't socialism. This is social, you know, democracy. This is social welfare capitalism. So, you know, a key part of what would a socialist alternative to the Democrats look like is it would be socialist, right? It wouldn't just reform capitalism. And as I said earlier, right, when you're reforming capitalism from within the capitalist parties, you're guaranteeing that there's a ceiling to what your reforms can do. They will not allow themselves to be reformed out of existence, right? That's just not something that is going to happen. So what does a socialist alternative to the Democrats look like? It's also got to be politically independent. Political independence must be adopted as a key principle, not merely a tactic to be used or dropped each election cycle. And I think that each election cycle is important. Right? It's important for independent socialist organizers. It's important for Greens to understand we're talking about long-term organizing. We're talking about long-term community building. We're talking about long-term empowerment. We're not talking about immediate gratification wins and, jumping cycle to cycle to cycle. We really have to be focused, you know, on putting the work in on that long-term ground game. So that means we need to be working on independent funding, right? Self-funded by workers and communities. Howie had a article during the campaign about called Sanders Socialism is New Deal Liberalism, which is correct, right? Sanders is a New Dealer, or his policies are, you know, his presidential campaign policies were New Deal, you know, reforms, essentially. But in that article, in that essay, he talked about how when Clinton was elected, he had the most moderate of moderate economic reforms in his program. And even then, what he learned was Wall Street gets a veto. Right? If you are not independently funded, that means capital will have the power to defund you, to shut you down. And that's what the Democratic Party of Nevada learned, right? That's what the Las Vegas DSA learned, or the DSA in Nevada learned when they took over the party, was that all of a sudden the funding dried up, the staff quit, and it was, you know, just the leadership sitting there trying, and part of the leadership was probably working against them. If you don't have that independent funding, you're, you know, really building your party on an unstable stack of cards. And not only that, it's an unstable capital stack of cards where the capitalists have a bat and they can take you down at any point, right? Independent ballot lines, working class candidates running on their own ballot lines with their own identity. Again, super, super important, right? Because there is, you know, there's always the rallying call from progressives to run and win in the primaries, but they don't, right? They run into many of the same problems that third parties run into, right? They're a grassroots campaign. that's ran on passion and no money, and they're running against someone who's been sitting in office raising $50,000 a day for their entire term, you know, or $50,000 a week or whatever the goal is for a U.S. House member, right? So they go in and they put all everything into these primaries, and then in the end, what are they left with? Right, they're in the same exact spot where they were, but they're actually have tied themselves into a party and into a strategy that leads them to then endorse the, you know, vote for the person that beat them, vote for the person they didn't think should be there.
And we had a funny story about this in Pittsburgh a few years back, where a progressive candidate that was inspired by Bernie Sanders ran for city council in the Democratic primary. And actually won the primary, was the Democratic nominee. The Democratic establishment of Pittsburgh got together, funded an insider to run as an independent, and flooded the campaign with so much money that they won as an independent. And they got the Democratic insider into office on an independent. and so the progressive was stuck with the Democratic name. Instead of building institutions that were going to allow a longer working class movement, you know, like that win didn't mean anything. It didn't build anything. So, you know, it's important for us to get our own funding and our own ballot line with our own identity instead of being tied to the Democrats, because actually the Democrats, they're not really, as that issue showed, they're not really that tied to the name Democratic Party either. It's about keeping their control. And if they have to pick another name or something like that, they will. So really this conversation is about building working class power, building our own institutions where we can actually, you know, raise ourselves up and actually engage in self-determination.
Like Nathaniel said, like India Walton in Buffalo, New York, who defeated their incumbent mayor in the primary. But then that mayor ran as an independent or a write-in and beat one in the general, right? And that's another one of the problems with the strategy of running within the primaries, is that there's a much smaller voting pool in the primaries, right? It tends to be passionate people that vote in the primaries. I remember people in 2016 talking about how, you know, Bernie's filling stadiums and Hillary's not even filling high school gyms, and that means something. Well, when you're the institutional candidate, you don't need to fill a stadium. You've got the votes, right? You've locked down the superdelegates. You've locked down all of your committee precinct people, right? So the people in the neighborhood who want Bernie are going and talking to Democrats in their community only to find out that they're already locked in. And so, you know,
especially in a party with superdelegates, how much does the primary vote even matter?
Yeah. So, you know, even when you can sway the primaries, that's a smaller sample of largely uber engaged voters. But when you get to the general, now you have to, you know, deal with, a more moderate base usually. It's why in all primaries in both Republicans and Democrats, you know, it's usually a battle between the institution and more extremes, but then they run right back to the center when it comes to the general. And tying into that, you know, an independent socialist party needs, Emoji, that's who we were talking about, was India Walton in Buffalo. It needs member control. Just as we call for social ownership of the means of production, the party itself must be owned by the members, right? Without independent leftist candidates running on the socialist program, the idea of socialism is watered down into what the Democratic Party is, you know, and what progressive Democrats are doing, which is mere reform and government programs, not social ownership, which was, you know, the absolute key. It's the basic definition of socialism. So we said earlier, right, that that the inside strategy has been tried, right? And there's a history of the independent left strategy too, right? Independent left parties carried progressive causes from the 1830s to the 1930s. You know, huge list: Working Man's Party, Liberty Party, Free Soil Party, Republicans. You know, talked about cooperative labor, abolition of land reform, radical reconstruction, right? With the Civil War, industrialization, and the kind of the battle for who was the biggest business party. That's what I think, you know, my problem with the argument, you know, the surface level shouting of the party's flipped, right? They didn't really flip. They just engaged in a battle over who was more pro-business. And we're still seeing that today, right? That is the key battle.
Or they support different industries that play off each other, but
yeah.
But it's, you know, it's capital against capital. It's not really a
yeah. So, you know, there's this long history of independent left parties, labor unions, and the Communist Party's Popular Front supported the New Deal coalition, and that really did a lot of damage to the left independent movements, right? That was a big bellwether moment the left collapsing into the Democratic Party. One thing that's not talked as often about that in that realm, in that time period, is how the world wars were used to rein in radical labor movements. They were a necessary part of the war machine. So, it was a big time when we saw, you know, traditionally socialist, you know, leftist bodies all of a sudden becoming patriotic and, towing government lines. And I think it is important, you know, despite all this history, the United States is one of the only modern industrial countries not to consolidate a major working class party independent from capital, right? We're going to talk about the one we used to have in the next slide, and they still do exist, but they are not a mass party. There's no real mass left independent party in the United States.
Before we get to that, though, I'd want to reiterate the point here that there's a long tradition through most of U.S. history here, actually, of independent politics. This idea of the two-party system that kind of reigns supreme and there's no other choice is actually a relatively new phenomena in U.S. history. It wasn't that weird to vote for other parties, especially when you were talking, you know, local state offices. You know, like, there were plenty of regional parties, if not national parties. And, you know, we've lost a lot of that in modern history, in part because of things like the first and the second Red Scare that were used to, you know, crush opponents of capitalism during the world wars, like Chris was saying, as well as the New Deal coalition that was the carrot to the stick, right, of trying to bring in unions and whatnot into the Democratic Party, where they served capital instead of creating that independent base that the working class needs to create systemic change.
And another important thing to remember about it, too, is they were successful. Right? And that does continue to today. Greens are generally successful when we are able to run, you know, real grassroots campaigns. You know, in the last year, I remember we ran a lot of local offices in Illinois. We won 67% of our races, right? And Greens are close to 50% of victories in all throughout history of all of our candidates. So, it wasn't just that these parties existed, but they won. And, you know, especially talking about labor socialism, right? The reason we have the 8-hour workday, child labor laws, like all of these things, is in part because we were not only, you know, saw active labor movements, but we were electing socialists, right, to city councils, as mayors, into state houses, into governorships, right? We were electing socialists, active, independent socialists. And so, you know, as it was said, this strictly two parties is really a post-New Deal era, phenomenon. Obviously, there were, our system breeds, you know, kind of a top two parties, but there was much more lively, both ideological and regional.
And I forget if it's later in the presentation or not, but just to kind of go on that point, you know, there's other countries in the world today that have voting systems similar to ours that still have the same plurality votes, first past the post, a lot of the same problems that we see today, but they still have, you know, more than two parties participating in their national governments. You know, the U.S. really stands out as only having this Republican Democrat dynamic.
And even when you get into independents, right, like Bernie, when Bernie was first elected to the House in the 90s, one of the first things that happened was he came to an agreement with the Democratic Party, right? That agreement was he would caucus with them, which means he'll largely vote with them, right? He'll support their leadership, and in exchange, he would get committee assignments. Even probably the most well-known independent of the modern era, his independence wasn't really independent from Capitol or the Democratic Party, right? It was very much an independence in name only. It tended to manifest itself in a loud bark with no bite. And we saw it kind of taken to its, what I would say, logical conclusion in terms of Bernie's rise, right? When Joe Biden was elected in 2020 and the House, the Democrats had control of the House and the Senate, Bernie got that big committee chair spot, right? Bernie got put in that position where he could supposedly guide progressive policies, through the Senate and through Congress. And what we saw was not that, right? What we saw was Build Back Badly and an abandonment of the social capital bill. And so even getting to that, even making those deals for, go 30 plus years and getting to that point where you were given the position of power, what we learned was that position of power actually isn't a position of power. It's a figurehead position that can easily be undermined when you stack the rest of the votes against the chair. So we said, it has existed in the past. We opened with that quote from Eugene Debs, which was, kind of a figurehead of, our case study, which is the Socialist Party of America. It's the only significant mass membership-based party in U.S. history. At its height, it had thousands of elected officials to state and local office, even a couple to Congress. It was very successful at influencing policy in the public debate. Two major differences it had from other leftist parties, and it learned these by experience. It banned fusion, required its candidates to run independently, and only dues-paying members could vote on internal party affairs. They maintained a membership convention system for endorsing candidates alongside the state-run primary system, and they would nominate and campaign for candidates in the primary if necessary to maintain independence. That's still true today, right? There are still dual systems where sometimes we're allowed to participate in things like primaries and sometimes in places we aren't. The Red Scare led to the jailing of Eugene Debs, the expulsion of Socialist Party members from state legislatures. By the 1930s, we talked about, right, the new labor was drawn into the New Deal coalition. And later, Socialist parties fractured even further, right? Some of it into form DSA and other organizations within a Democratic Party, some of them into PSL, the Party for Socialism and Liberation came out of the SP of A. And then parties like the Workers' World Party came out of PSL. in many ways, the Socialist Party of America was kind of the trunk of the modern leftist political party system, and we've seen it kind of fracture off in different branches and limbs. But it's really the only example we have of this mass membership party in the United States, and it was incredibly successful until it was snuffed out by the Red Scare and the associated nonsense of those decades. And they still do exist. I will, the Socialist Party of the United States is still in existence. I've have been a dual member in the past. They endorsed Howie Hawkins and Angela Walker in 2020, which was huge. I don't believe they've endorsed a Green like that before. So it was a really big thing for, you know, building that relationship long term. But they are a shadow of their former selves today. So where does that leave us, right? Bottom up organizing, not top down mobilizing. And I think those are good. That's an important distinction. Not just the bottom up and top down, but organizing versus mobilizing, right? And we talked about this kind of in our organizing workshops in the past. The difference between advocacy and mobilizing and organizing. And I can't remember, I don't think it was Lee Staples that gave us that, but I can't remember who we were quoting with that. You know, but advocacy is what we have in the major parties, right? The expectation that a organization of power will advocate for you on behalf of your issues, which clearly doesn't pan out in the real world. Then there's mobilizing, which is bringing out your base to pass your things, right? It's very one directional. It's very, top down and oriented towards completing goals that are established by elites. And then there's bottom up organizing, where not only are we trying to mobilize our people, right? Obviously, when we organize, the first thing we do is find our socialists, right? The first thing we do is find the people that want to form an organization like we do. So we start with our people, but a key part of organizing is changing minds. A key part, and if we aren't doing that, then we aren't going to be forming a mass party, right? To form a mass party, we have to change the collective consciousness. We have to not only get all the socialists into the streets, but convince the majority of America that socialists aren't evil demons.
One way that I like to describe the organizing is organizers should be planning to kind of put themselves out of work, that your major goal as an organizer is to train other organizers and let them go off and do things. And that is how we not only educate about socialist ideas, but it's also how we kind of build that trust and that solidarity that's necessary in order to build a mass working class organization, because we're letting, I don't mean it that way, but we're encouraging communities to represent themselves, to learn the skills necessary to organize themselves and to create democratic structures for self-governance among themselves. Like Chris was saying earlier, it's of the people, not for the people. And so that's the heart of organizing here. The concept of advocacy versus mobilizing versus organizing, I think that comes from Jane McAlevey,
yeah,
who is a major union organizer. And she has a book called There's No Shortcuts. And I always like that phrase too. There's no shortcuts to organizing power. We have to understand that this is kind of a long-term protracted struggle that's not going to get resolved in one election cycle. Or even a few election cycles. It's a long-term process of changing the culture and the economic system into the eco-socialist system that we want to see.
Yeah, and I think that the key thing that we need to remember when we're talking bottom up, is that that's where we can actually change minds. Right, I said we need to build this mass party, that we need to overcome, the propagandizing that our population has had about, the left and socialist ideals, to the point that, like, a couple weeks ago it was even in The Last of Us, right, where it's like, that sounds like communism, and it's like, no, it's not communism, and then the wife jumps in, we live on a commune, it's communism, right? We've got to get past that, right? And when we're talking about, even something like this, right? When we're talking about talking to people on social media, talking to national level organizations, it's hard to break through, right? But where we can actually have success breaking through is bottom up with our neighbors in our community, right? You know, a couple quick, you know, things that that brings to mind is, you know, last winter there was a well-known activist in my community, and we had a real bad snowstorm, and they were driving, you know, I don't remember where they were going, driving home or whatever, and they saw someone off the side of the road. So they pulled over, jumped out, helped push them out. And I bet they did this a couple dozen times over the course of the day, or the course of the, you know, the 24 hours where we had the bad snow and the roads were bad. They just made it a point to go out and help people, right? Because that's what socialists tend to do. And they, you know, they helped push this guy out, and the guy afterwards shook their hand and said, "I'm Bob." And I said, "Oh, well, I'm Bill." And the guy went like this, and he said, "You're not like how I thought you were." Right? His reputation as a leftist organizer preceded him. His name was known amongst right wingers. But when one of them met him on the streets, he helped them. Right? And it broke that. Right? The next time he hears, you know, all that guy's this, that, and another thing, he's probably at least internally going to think, yeah, but he's a nice guy who helped out when I needed it. Even if he doesn't say it, right? There's a crack in the bauble. There's a stress point that we can exploit, right? I'm a situationist. When we see those, we hit them. And that's one way we can create those cracks, is through those interpersonal interactions with people in our community. I had another friend who ran an anarchist community space in a sundown town of 5,000 people in central Illinois. If you don't know what a sundown town is, it's a town where historically black folks needed to leave by sundown. That's where the name came from, right? So we're talking think exactly what you probably stereotypically think when I say downstate Illinois, right? A town that has had all of its manufacturing leave, very, very, very conservative, lots of reactionary and problematic views. And my friend's running an anarchist space that has an anarcho-capitalist flag painted two stories tall on the front of the building, right? Bullet holes in the windows from people driving by and taking pot shots. But on one occasion, he had a gentleman in a suit walk in, hand him $500 and say, "I hate everything that you stand for, but you're the only person in this town who's doing anything for the kids," right? He still didn't like him as a person. He thought his politics were shit, but he had to give him credit. He had to support the only person doing the work. And that same friend has sat down with, you know, people who are friends with the people who are shooting his windows out, right? And had conversations. And at the end they say, you know, "Well, that's what you're talking about?" And he's like, "Yeah, that's what I'm talking about." And there's like, people wouldn't want to shoot you if they knew that was what you were talking about. Like, he literally got told that, like, "I know people who want to kill you, but if they sat down and had this conversation, they wouldn't." So I think it's really important to, you know, remember that when we're talking about bottom-up organizing, it's not just about, you know, the broader strategy, but about the fact that it's actually the one place we can reach people, right? We can't reach people screaming at a stranger on the internet. We can't, you know, we very rarely reach people standing at a mass protest, right? Where we reach them is talking to the people in our community. So that was a big way tangent.
It was a good one, and it's related to these points here, I think, actually, because it's you know, I think those opportunities for interpersonal actions where communications where you can change minds. A lot of that happens when, like you're saying, you get involved in your community to do things that the local establishment has forgotten about, the local power structures have forgotten about. And that applies to a lot of the people in those communities themselves. The Democratic electoral machine likes to call them apathetic, that they don't care about politics, because if they cared, they would come out and vote in the primary. That's not true for most of them. Most of them feel completely alienated by this system. They don't feel represented by it, and they recognize how hard it is to make a change, and they feel demoralized by that. So they've simply withdrawn from the process altogether. They say, why should I even waste my time on this? Because no one's going to listen to me. No one's going to do anything. No one's going to fix it. I might as well stay in my community and give $500 to the anarchist who's actually doing something. And when you look at polls, like half of registered voters are independents. Like, they already don't really believe in the Republican-Democrat divide. And that's half of all voters. When you look at actually all voting age population, like half of the population isn't even registered to vote or doesn't vote and that sort of thing. And that's actually where our base is. That's actually the members that we need to be reaching out to and recruiting and talking to them and saying, you know, we understand why you're alienated. We understand why you feel demoralized. And the answer to those things is to organize, to get together with other members in our community and start linking those communities together into a larger mass movement where we can actually have the working class power to change these things and represent ourselves and get the policies that we want passed and not just what the Democratic or Republican elite tell us that they're going to do. So, you know, that's where this bottom-up organizing starts from. It's from those very personal conversations, getting involved in your community and reaching out to the people that the system has forgotten, because there's a lot of those people who are forgotten and are just not sure where to start. And if we can start those conversations with them, you know, they'll get involved.
So what does it mean to bottom-up organize, right? It means the ruling middle-class political... So what we're talking about is the ruling middle-class political alliance only prevails in elections because the working class votes in low numbers, right? Many members of the working class feel alienated, demoralized at the prospects of making change against the elites. It's not apathy, but a lack of organization to change. And I'll also, you know, say here, you'll see this explode in your community every once in a while, right? Where all of a sudden, like, your neighbors, someone in your neighborhood is just pissed off at your alder person and they run. Right, there's somebody down the block for me that he's a write-in, and our alder person is who is behind him being kicked off the ballot. Right, that it was that person's people who challenged his signatures, and I wish I would have. This is a failing on my part, right? That I'm not engaged enough doing this door knocking and doing. I'm not practicing what I preach, but I wish I would have known that he was running and collecting signatures when he was running and collecting signatures. Because that's where I have experience, right, as a third person with a third party, knowing what's needed to overcome, you know, the challenges that are going to come. So we see this, right? And if you look at your community, I think almost all of our communities will see it, where you have that flash of, like, a candidate that's just running because someone pissed them off, right? And that means it's one of the many signals that, you know, there is a demand for independent politics. There is demand for an alternative party. There is a demand for something different. And we have to be there ready for those flashpoints, right? Yeah, because if we had had, if my Green Party had had basically a bomb set off in the middle of it last year because of some stuff that happened with a member, like, we might have been prepared to lift that person up in that moment, in that flashpoint, right, and support them. So again, like, right, people aren't apathetic. They're alienated and they withdraw from it because you can only participate in your own destruction consciously for so long, right? It wears down on you, and you either do one of two things. You explode and run a firebrand grassroots campaign that loses, or you withdraw and you focus your you know, efforts elsewhere in your community. We can build, you know, so we need to build a base by filling the political vacuum for this working class, right? We need to prioritize outreach to Black, Latinx, communities of color, youth, queer folks, you know, across the board, the oppressed and marginalized, right? If you're in an area that has, you know, if you're in a more rural area, like, rural folks are marginalized as hell, right? Rural communities have been completely abandoned economically, politically, across the board. The reason that we see this deep red, you know, rural divide in the United States, in my opinion, is more because that no one else but the Republicans is there, right? They've been abandoned by the Democrats. They've been abandoned by socialists. They've been abandoned by progressives. All they have is libertarians and Republicans. And they're there to stir hate right? And to other and to blame others for the problems that are actually caused by capitalism, right? The collapse of the small farm is because of capitalism. The outsourcing of rural manufacturing is because of capitalism. The effects of climate change are because of capitalism, right? But the only people they have speaking to them are capitalists. So we need to kind of qualify the lead and think about who we're talking to. And another, I think, key thing when we're qualifying the lead is who has material interest in change, right? If someone... Who's going to, hypothetical, who's going to fight harder for Medicare for All, the uninsured person or the union member with a sweet, contract negotiated deal? Well, all the AFL-CIO and their opposition to Medicare for All tells us that, right? They're going to bail on it, right? And it's not true across the board, right? There are people of privilege who have health insurance who will fight tooth and nail for it. But most of the time, I'm going to place my money that when the going gets tough, it's the person who needs it, the person with that material interest that's going to, stick through to the end and not take a buy-off half measure. Organizing means we need to be facilitating working class folks getting together to make their own decisions, learn democratic processes through experience. Our society doesn't encourage this. Our society doesn't encourage democratic decision making. Our society doesn't encourage, collective discussion. It came up in my personal life with someone, with something recently. Just the re-realization that our society does not provide avenues for conflict resolution, for restorative justice, for any of these things. Right. So we have to condition ourselves and train ourselves to actually do these things, to break the mold of authoritarianism that we're living in and raised in. That means, educational and social movement projects, not only electoral campaigns. We've got to be part of the organizing, right? We've got to be in our communities 24/7, 365, not just coming around for finite campaigns. And when we do come around for a finite campaign, we need to start at the bottom, right? We need to start with ideally people from the movement. Right, not someone coming in to advocate, but someone who wants to speak for themselves and their community. And we kind of mentioned it earlier, but I think another important point to remember is that, the same kind of issues arise in community and issue organizing with democratic front groups. There's a saying that I meant to Google it, but I didn't. To see if I could find a source, but the Democratic Party is the graveyard of social movements. I'm sure every person on the left has heard it. I'm sure most people on the left have said it, but it's true, right? Whether it be political parties like the Labor Party, or social movements, the Democratic Party tends to absorb and corrupt. Right? You get like how we would say during 2020, they get lost in the sauce, even if they can keep their identity, but usually they don't even do that. Usually there might be some baseline level appeasement that brings them in to, kind of like that New Deal coalition, right? You get a little, you come in, and then you find out that you're slowly fading away, or you're just immediately fading away. So there are a litany of Democratic Party line community and issue groups that serve to funnel energy into supporting Democratic parties and attempting to influence policy from within. These organizations vary in their connection from official connections, right? Where you're officially part of, your Democratic Party apparatus, all the way to, non-partisan organizations whose leadership are simply Democrats. And therefore, that's the only perspective that is allowed at the table. It doesn't even have to be conscious all the time. I remember that. I remember when during Occupy, we were meeting in our local AFSCME headquarters, and during one of the meetings, I raised the question: should we start finding a new meeting place? Because the elections are coming up and we're meeting under a picture of Obama, And that suggestion was taken very badly by the Democrats in the room, who could not believe I would accuse them of, you know, having any kind of allegiance to the party over the movement. And they got even more mad when I told them to come talk to me next April when they would all be gone. And come next April, they were all gone working on Democratic campaigns, right? So even, you know, in a movement like Occupy, there was those unconscious guides. So what this means is that much of the civic energy in our society is being co-opted and often funded by capitalist interests, right? So for the same reason, and that funding is a linchpin, right? That funding is key, like we talked about, right? When you build your funding on capitalist, you know, sources, and the capitalists have the baseball bat, that's a very, very precarious house of cards that you've built. You know, and more so than parties, maybe these social organs, civic organizations, are beholden to those donors, right? They have staffs and all kinds of things that are reliant on that next benevolent check coming in. So that's that same reason we must have independent political parties that are independent of capital. Our social movements have to be as well. It makes me think of a job I almost got a decade ago where I applied to be a political director for an environmental not-for-profit. Everything went well. I thought I had the job. I got a call from the executive director personally to tell me they really, really loved me, but someone with 25 years experience applied for the job too. And they had to make a choice between someone who could hit the ground running right now and someone who was more in line with where they wanted to go but would need to build there. And so they took the short-term choice. And just a few months later, while I was with other fractivists sitting in outside of our governor's office, and people were taking arrests on a daily basis opposing calling for a moratorium on fracking in Illinois, that person who got the job instead of me was in the governor's office with the oil and gas industry, with the Sierra Club, writing the law that legalized fracking in Illinois. So when push came to shove, probably partially, related to that person in charge, internal bias, right? That they had an experienced lobbyist who was used to working for compromise, not for values. But also, I am sure that funding was on the line on how they came down on those fights.
Oh yeah, we have a number of environmental organizations in Pennsylvania that are that way, that, you know, kind of rely on the Democratic machine as part of their fundraising and outreach, and they get stuck in that same lesser evil argument of like supporting the Democratic Party, that at every level in Pennsylvania, from our local in Pittsburgh up to the state, has been in favor of fracking, has been in favor of expanding the petrochemical industry, and all of these environmental problems that we're seeing in the state. The Democrats have been behind that and have pushed it, but you end up with these nonprofits that call them the climate champions compared to the Republicans, right? Because they pick the lesser evils, so to speak, even though all of this is bipartisan legislation. The emphasis starts to be on what the donors want, what the donors are telling the Democratic Party. And so you start to see an emphasis on, instead of getting rid of fracking, it's, well, we want to work with the governor to try to put sensible regulations on how much emissions that fracking should have. And you could see how things start to get watered down because of being involved in the Democratic Party, because of being involved with their donors, because of this sense that, you know, you have to compromise with capitalism as opposed to, building a movement that's really going to demand something different. And so instead you see citizens' movements. Instead, we have citizens' movements that are independent, that have, for example, in some townships in Western Pennsylvania, they at the local level passed local ordinances to ban fracking within their municipality. They can't by themselves change the state, but they can ban it in their municipality. And so, you know, they're taking a stand against Republicans and Democrats by organizing themselves locally in these independent groups. And I think we can take a lot of, learn a lot from those experiences. The key thing being we have to remain independent.
So we're coming to the close on this one, but just to reiterate, right? The Green Party is both an activist organization and an electoral party, right? And multi-tendency, right? We started off with quotes from Debs, Marx, Lenin, and Emma Goldman. We covered a pretty good span of the left. It's important to keep this in mind, right? Because we just talked a whole lot about parties, and in the very narrow view of the role of political parties in the United States, of the role of memberless parties in the United States, that means that it kind of often just gets blurred into just electoralism, right? But part of being independent means that we need our movements to be independent too, right? The movement side and the electoral side are two parts of a larger strategy, not either or decisions that we have to make. So, we really have to extend that, make sure that we're extending that into that that independence through all of our politics, through all of our organizing. That said, we went a little longer than I wanted, but not too bad. Like we said, this is our first time doing this specific topic. I'm sure we will come back to it at another point, with a little bit of an update. But if you want to, learn more about us, here at the Green Socialist Organizing Project, you can go to greensocialist.net. We've got lots of ways you can get involved. You can get involved in political education, which is these workshops, these one-on-ones. We just did our Ukraine Green Socialist Perspectives on Ukraine panel last week. We've got our weekly podcast with Howie. We're working on another political theory podcast right now. So there's lots of things you can do with us in education. We have lists of things to do that are far larger than we can accomplish at our current capacity. So we'd be more than happy to have you involved. You can get involved in party building work, and helping support election campaigns, and working on different issues, things, whether that be white paper, policy statements, or trying to organize actual movement stuff. You can go sign up at greensocialist.net. You can become a member of the organization, which helps us pay for StreamYard to do this and all that kind of stuff. Keep our websites up, that. But also, we said you need membership organizations. So we have monthly meetings. Our last monthly meeting was actually last Sunday. We talk about strategy. We talk about what we're doing. We talk about current events in the Green Party in the world. There you can get involved and actually guide, our work here in the Green Socialist Organizing Project. Specifically, if you want to get involved in our education working group, I encourage you to sign up, via the main sign up on the website. But you can also email me directly at chris@howiehawkins.us. And with that, thank you very much, everybody. And let me see if there's any last minute. Thank you very much, everybody. And we will see you next month, fourth Tuesday of every month at 8 p.m. Eastern. We're continuing these 101s. Like I said at the beginning, in 2022, we went Green Party Eco-Socialism Organizing, Green Party Eco-Socialism Organizing. They were long. They dove into a lot of things. So in 2023, our focus is to kind of break out a little. And this independent politics was our first 101 breakout where we talked about this topic that frankly had been talked about in every single workshop before, and clearly deserved you know, its own time. If you have a suggestion, right, on a topic that we could do on these one-on-ones, go ahead and throw it in the chat or send me, like I said, send me an email at chris@howiehawkins.us and we can see what we can do. But have a good evening, everybody, and we'll see you next month.
See you then.